to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Sarah Martin in Adelaide. Today on The Wire...
We don't believe rhinos should be bred like livestock. They're wild animals. They need to be in the wild, quite frankly. And in our opinion, this is really about profit.
Does the legal sale of rhino horn have damaging consequences? And...
Women being able to have that opportunity to be supported in managing their disease during pregnancy is a really, really important initiative.
Mental health in pregnancy is now covered by Medicare. Also on the show, the cleanest water on earth available in Antarctica and the impact of sly grog on Queensland's Indigenous communities. Stay tuned for these stories and more coming up on The Wire. First, we have Aislinn Rossi from the newsroom here with the news headlines. Hi, Aislinn.
Hi, Sarah.
First, in international news, North Korea is reportedly ramping up missile production.
Yes, a statement by the state-run news agency reveals that Kim Jong-un ordered military scientists to boost production of solid-fuel rocket engines, which are easier to hide from satellites and faster to launch. The top US military officer, General Joseph Dunford, warned this week that while the US is looking for a peaceful solution, it is also ready to defend itself.
Do we have the capability to defend the peninsula? Do we have the capability to defend Guam, Hawaii, and the United States? The answer is yes, we do.
Now and into the future.
Now and into the future.
Also abroad, a former CIA agent is attempting to get Trump kicked off Twitter.
Yes, but she needs $1 billion to do it. The plan is to buy enough shares in the company that Twitter is forced to suspend President Trump's account. The founder of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, has previously told CNN that he has no plans to do so.
We want to make sure we hold all of our accounts to the same terms of service, but ultimately we want to make sure that we're guiding everyone towards better usage of the platform.
So far, Dorsey says Trump hasn't breached their terms of service, but Wilson thinks $1 billion might just persuade them otherwise.
And back home, the challenges over citizenship that went to the High Court today have been postponed. When will a decision be made?
So the hearings have been pushed to mid-October so that the legal teams for Senators Matthew Canavan and Malcolm Roberts can call on foreign experts. The Deputy Prime Minister was among those before the court today, while Deputy Nationals Leader Fiona Nash and SA Senator Nick Xenophon are still waiting to be formally referred.
Also in citizenship news, the Law Council of Australia has slammed the changes first announced back in April.
Yes, in a submission to the Senate inquiry, they argued that an English language test for prospective applicants is not justified and a test on so-called Australian values is an unprecedented overreach by the government. They also say they give the Immigration Minister too much power by allowing judgments by the Administrative Appeals Tribunal to be ignored.
Thanks, Aislinn.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
Alcohol management plans are having a detrimental effect for Indigenous people living in rural communities in Queensland. According to a new report, alcohol management plans are not leading to less alcohol consumption, but rather an increase in sly grog being brought in from surrounding areas. Professor Alan Clough told The Wire's Taylor Cullingford about the effects sly grog is having in communities with alcohol management plans.
So how is this information gathered?
Well, that paper that you're referring to is a study that was done as part of a much larger study, which is evaluating the impacts of alcohol management plans in Queensland's Indigenous communities. We've been doing that work for some time. The issue of sly grog and home brew is one of the unintended consequences we found as we were doing that evaluation study.
What did the research find?
Your listeners might not be aware of alcohol management plans and how they work, but they're basically liquor restrictions in very small places, places that are around about the size of a suburb in a city. So if your listeners could imagine that there's an invisible legal boundary around your suburb and you're not allowed to possess or consume any alcohol within that suburb, with police being able to set up roadblocks and search a vehicle and so forth. That's the kind of situation that exists in a number of remote Indigenous communities where there's total prohibition. Some communities have some alcohol permitted, but not all of them. So that's the picture. Now, 10 years ago, alcohol management plans were tightened so that 8 out of the 19 communities where they are in place have complete prohibition, like I was just talking about. Complete prohibition came after a decade or more where alcohol was readily available and even available in the community. So there'd been a pattern or style of alcohol consumption that had developed in the preceding decade. Then from 2008, we basically had total prohibition in some of these communities.
Were these results surprising?
Well, this isn't a new problem. It's been around for quite a while, but it's just that we're the first ones to document it in the way that we have right across the affected communities. I guess we were surprised mostly by the extremes that we found. Extreme activities like the smuggling tactics that the sly grog sellers use, tactics such as driving as fast as they possibly can at night with the lights out and taking huge risks to deliver illicit alcohol into communities, and also the extreme profit rates that some people were making, selling a bottle of spirits that can be purchased between $30 and $40 in a city centre for something like $400 in these remote communities where there's prohibition. So these things are rather extreme and affects everybody.
What do you believe is the course of action which would limit these problems?
Sly grog has been, because of the alcohol restrictions and the legislation and regulation around it, it's been a problem that mainly police have had to try to solve. And clearly that's not working. There's not enough resources for police to completely control all the alcohol. So there needs to be a different approach. And part of that different approach needs to look at reducing the demand for alcohol in these places and treating the people who have addiction problems with appropriate treatment services so that we get away from thinking of this as not a police problem but a health problem, which is a much more constructive way to move forward. But also the other key to this is the reason why people are wanting to trade and make money out of it, and that is that there are little other employment opportunities in the local community, so it's very tempting to make a quick profit. So the social determinants of the issue need to be addressed as well.
Professor Alan Clough ending that report by The Wire's Taylor Cullingford. Pregnancy and the birth of a child is supposed to be an exciting time for families. However, for some women, pregnancy and birth can have a series of negative effects on their mental health. The government has introduced the funding of mental health assessments through Medicare to try and support mothers who may be struggling during and after pregnancy. Professor Vicky Clifton from Brisbane-based Mater Research told The Wire's Rebecca St. Clair just how many women are affected by depression and anxiety during pregnancy.
Based on our study, 25% of women that would be classified as healthy actually have a pre-existing history of either depression or anxiety. And women that have a chronic disease, such as diabetes or asthma, about 50% of those women have some sort of mental health issue.
Does your research continue to postnatal depression and anxiety, and what did it show in regards to that?
So we haven't followed women up in relation to postnatal depression. Our focus has been on pregnancy and the events that occur during pregnancy for women that have a history of depression and looking at anxiety. One of the interesting things is that anxiety increased as pregnancy progressed. In terms of depression, what we see is women with depression who manage their depression quite well seem to actually get a bit better as pregnancy progresses, which we think is maybe something to do with change in the hormone profile as pregnancy progresses, but we're not sure. One of the caveats behind that, though, is if you do suffer from depression, you're more likely to have postnatal depression.
What resources are already in place for women who are suffering through anxiety and depression pre or postnatal?
We actually did our study at the Lyell McEwen Hospital in Elizabeth Vale in South Australia, and their management of depression is quite good. So what they do is they identify women who have depression at the beginning of pregnancy and then provide them with the appropriate support throughout gestation to manage their disease. That's not the case for all hospitals. It varies from one hospital to the next. So we think it's important that there is a consistent approach in, first of all, identifying those women that are at risk and then providing them with the appropriate support.
The government has announced that it plans to fund mental health assessments for women who are pregnant under Medicare. What does having access to mental health mean for those that are pregnant, and what effects does early intervention have?
It's really, really important. It does mean that women can have a discussion about what's happening with their mental health during their pregnancy and seek the appropriate support to manage it. We know that it results in better outcomes for the children in terms of both their academic as well as their physical health. Women being able to have that opportunity to be supported in managing their disease during pregnancy is a really, really important initiative.
Beyond this funding, are there other measures that need to be taken to ensure the mental health of pregnant women or women who have just given birth is looked after?
I think it's important for women to recognise how they're feeling, and if they aren't feeling particularly good, if they're feeling down, if they're not feeling like doing their usual activities, if they're feeling excessively tired, it's probably important to start to think about what's going on and to at least have a discussion initially with friends and family and then with your GP.
What was the most surprising part of your research in your eyes?
I think we were surprised to see that depression improves as pregnancy progresses and starts to raise questions from a scientific perspective about whether there are antidepressant properties of being pregnant. And it's something that we were thinking about a little bit more. And it may actually reveal new avenues for treating depression. One of the other things that did come up, we looked at quality of life in women who had either depression or asthma. And what we found there was that as pregnancy progresses, both physical and mental well-being seems to worsen in women, especially women with a chronic disease such as asthma. There are different groups of women and they all respond differently to what's happening in pregnancy. Your mental health as well as your chronic disease needs to be managed in pregnancy because it's a time when there's lots of changes happening.
Professor Vicky Clickburn from the Mater Research Institute speaking to The Wire's Rebecca St. Clair. Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Yesterday, the first legal sale of rhino horn began in South Africa. Despite the horn being sourced from tranquilised bred rhinos in an attempt to curb poaching, the sale has raised questions about the impact it will have on demand and those who protect the animals on the front line. The Wire's Rachel McDonald has the story.
Rhino horn is in high demand on the black market, with popularity driven from Vietnam and China. Christina Pretorius is from the International Fund for Animal Welfare in Southern Africa. She says it's having a high toll on the wild population.
Well over 7,000 rhinos have in fact been poached for their horns in the past few years, just here in South Africa, so it's really most concerning to us.
Why do you believe legalising rhino horn trade will increase demand for the product?
Generally speaking, there simply aren't the checks and balances in place worldwide to properly manage the illegal trade of rhino horn. It's flooding over our borders. We're looking at upwards of one rhino a day being killed for their horns at the moment, mostly for markets in Vietnam and China, and simply there just aren't the checks and balances to properly manage that.
Is horn removal itself a humane option for keeping rhinos safe?
Well, we don't believe so. I mean, the fact of the matter is that Mr. Hume, who's the gentleman who's actually selling part of his rhino horn stockpile, he's made it quite clear that he's selling that horn to enable himself to better protect his rhino herd. He has about 1,500 of these animals. He basically breeds them pretty much like livestock. We don't believe rhinos should be bred like livestock. They're wild animals. They need to be in the wild, quite frankly. And in our opinion, this is really about profit. Mr. Hume is about to realise, I mean, a king's ransom. in profit from these horns. He's not intending to divert any of the profits to protecting wild rhino herds at all. This is really all about profit.
Christina Pretorius from the International Fund for Animal Welfare in Southern Africa. The protection and sale of horn from captive rhinos is also contentious to Sean Willsmore, founder of the Thin Green Line Foundation, who says that cutting off horns of wild rhinos does not ensure their safety.
In farm populations, well, every and small reserve populations where every rhino is being dehorned, you can understand the poachers wouldn't come there. But in a wild situation, they'll often shoot the animal just so they don't track it again, or because the stub that's left on the nose of the rhino horn is still worth money, they'll still kill the rhino for that stub that's left. So I think we need to evolve as a humanity and actually just stop trading in rhino horn altogether.
What do you think needs to be done to deter these poachers?
What we've shown is where we have well-equipped, well-trained rangers on the front line of conservation and engaging the communities, poaching decreases. A good friend of ours was killed on Friday. He was actually most likely murdered by poaching syndicates because he was protecting actually elephants in this case and actually sending high-level poachers to jail. He was a great advocate for actually engaging the local community in conservation. And once you did that, making them park rangers is one way, training those people as park rangers, giving them a pride in their natural resources, and then you've got a chance of protecting rhinos.
Sean Willsmore, founder of the Thin Green Line Foundation. Lynn Johnson is founder of Breaking the Brand, an organisation that aims to stigmatise the trade of rhino horn. She says the real driver for the whole process is the demand for rhino horn from Vietnam and China.
Rhino horn is used in Vietnam as a status symbol. So men use it to negotiate business deals and gain favours because it's seen as a precious item. And it gives them status in the fact that they can negotiate business deals with it. It gives them power in their business community. It's a new fad, and it's not a traditional Asian medicine.
Is there a possibility that legalising the trade of rhino horn would make it less of a status symbol?
No, because the people who use it as a status symbol are not interested in horn from a domesticated farmed animal. It doesn't have the same status, so they don't see it as a substitute product. So while there is interest in rhino horn, they will always want horn from a wild rhino that's been killed. My question to the likes of John Hume, who's one of the pro-trade farmers and who's selling horn, and to the South African government, if their statement is that they're legalising trade to reduce the poaching, the user analysis that we've done, because they say that they're not interested in a horn from a farm domesticated product, they don't see it as a substitute product, then it won't stop the poaching. So we don't see any benefit to legalising trade.
What do you think would need to be done to deter poachers from killing rhinos in the wild?
It all comes down to stopping the demand. The people who are buying the rhino horn, they drive the supply chain. They prop up the traffickers, they prop up the poachers. So if they didn't buy it anymore, there would be no reason to poach rhinos.
How do you think the demand could be reduced?
Well, you have to speak to them in a message that they care about and they only care about themselves. When we interviewed the users of rhino horn in Vietnam, they said the only two reasons they would stop using rhino horn was if it negatively impacted their health or it negatively impacted their status. So the campaigns that we've been creating have been sending out those types of messages. So, for instance, we're saying that if a businessman needs to use rhino horn to prop up a business deal, he's not a particularly good businessman, because true leaders and good businessmen make deals based on their competence and their commercial acumen. They don't need props of rhino horn.
Lynn Johnson, founder of Breaking the Brand, entering that report by The Wire's Rachel McDonald. Researchers at Australia's Davis Research Station in Antarctica will soon be drinking some of the cleanest water in the world, and it will all be recycled from wastewater created on site. Professor Stephen Gray is Director of the Institute for Sustainability and Innovation at Victoria University. His team has been working with researchers from across Australia to design and test a wastewater treatment plant that can operate in Antarctica's unique conditions.
There is technology available to convert wastewater into drinking water, but it usually requires some close attention and access to laboratory skills. But when we take the small systems down to the Antarctic, where access to skills and facilities is limited, it becomes quite challenging. A lot of the emphasis in our work was about how do we design and construct a system that we know will operate, we can verify the processing conditions, and we can infer the water quality. And so that's what we were doing down in Tasmania.
So you used a test site down there to make sure that you were getting all of these things right before you've shipped anything off, is that right?
That's correct. So it had to perform with a limited amount of operator intervention. So while we were testing it, we were collecting water samples for monitoring, but we were trying not to alter the operation of the plant, so it was running in an automated fashion, and we were just verifying its performance down there. So we ran that for about 9 months. There were a few minor issues that came up in that time, and Australian Antarctic Division have rectified those, and for the last 12 months they've been operating it in an unattended mode, so we know that it can operate that way.
Do you have to consider the temperatures? Does that affect the process and the effectiveness of the system?
Yes, it would, but in this instance, the treatment plant will be housed in a constant temperature building. So they have issues down there with high winds and very cold temperatures, and if it was left out in the open, the treatment plant wouldn't last very long. So what they will do is install that in a building, and it will be maintained at a temperature of 19 degrees throughout the year.
Just in terms of the challenges that need to be met with down in Antarctica, why are people not able to maintain it down there? What are the constrictions of the location?
There will be some maintenance possible down there. The type of personnel that Australian Antarctic Division will take down there are very good tradespeople, so they will operate this wastewater treatment plant, the recycling plant, but also the power supply and other facilities down there. So they need to be very good tradespeople, but that means that we can't guarantee they will be expert in operating water treatment plants. So there is some allowance for having to do regular maintenance, but the skills in understanding the process and the way that it's operating will be done remotely, so we can have people back in Australia monitoring the performance. There's also the issue that they get a supply once a year, so we can't be bringing in spare parts or having samples taken for analysis at regular intervals. So it has to also operate with a minimum amount of consumable materials, because space on the ship each year is quite competitive and you have to fight to get your materials on that ship.
And this is going into Australia's Davis Research Station down there, and you're claiming it will be some of the cleanest water in the world. What's the basis for that?
Well, by the time it's gone through this process, it'll be extremely clean. Essentially, if someone gets sick down there, that's quite a significant portion of the population. So we have to be able to deal with high amounts of contamination in the wastewater. So there's a lot of treatment barriers in the process. By the time it gets through to the end, it's gone through about 7 steps, and at the end it's quite pure. So there's very little in the way of chemicals within the water, and certainly no microbiology that will cause anyone illness.
There would still be some residual waste from the process. What happens with that?
The actual impetus for this project was to clean up their wastewater discharge into the Antarctic Ocean. That was also a key criteria for the project, was to produce a very clean waste for disposal. So within the process we have a reverse osmosis stage, and so from that stage we separate out the salts and other contaminants and they get discharged to the ocean. But before we hit the reverse osmosis stage, we've also got processes such as ozonation and biological activated carbon, which help pull out and destroy trace organic compounds, so pharmaceuticals or other types of compounds that may still be in the water. And so by the time it goes to discharge from the reverse osmosis brine, it's still quite pure.
Are you hoping that other research stations maybe consider this and take this on board if we can prove that it works for the Aussies?
I would hope so, and I know the Australian Australian Antarctic Division are taking it down to Davis Station and thinking if this works well, we can haul it into the other research stations we have down there. But I would hope that other countries such as the USA and China would also look over at what we're doing and think that was something good they could implement on their own stations as well.
Professor Stephen Gray, Director of the Institute for Sustainability and Innovation at Victorian University. That's it for The Wire today. If you'd like to hear any of our stories again or have your say on our stories, head to our website, thewire.org.au. There you can also sign up to podcasts of the show so you never miss an episode. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for The Wire Radio or one word. This show is a team effort by 2SER, Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane. And you can hear us on your radio or online across Australia weekdays.
Let's enjoy new stuff, old stuff, a real variety.
My pleasure.
And yay!
2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.